morning. This is City Council Workshop. It's Tuesday, May the 8th, 2012. Present this morning is Councilman Jay Musley, Councilman John McLeod, Mayor Kent Gwynn, Councilman Daniel Owen, Councilwoman Mary Sue Rich, and myself, Councilwoman Susie Heimbachel, and Matt Browers, the City Manager. We're going to talk today about airport minimum standards, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Brower.
Thank you, Council President. I'm going to turn the time over to Matt Grower, Airport Director, to lead us off.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're here to talk about minimum standards. It's definitely a recurring theme. We've discussed this innumerable times, all the way back since I can remember, back in 2005. It's come up when we received some unsolicited requests for an FBO operation from a company called Oracle Aviation. It's come up when Shelter Aviation looked into developing an FBO at the airport, and we're talking back in 2006, 2007. It's come up when we've issued various requests for proposals for both specifically FBO operations and fairly broad spectrum FBO RFPs, where we were just looking for aviation and non-aviation development. The issue at the center of the minimum standards is whether our current standards are flexible enough to allow an increase in aviation businesses while still maintaining the high levels of service that we expect at the Ocala Airport. Most recently, we're working with Ocala Jet Center. They were responded to a previous RFP, they have proposed an FBO operation on the west side of the airport. We looked at the minimum standards, and we made some changes to it, passed them through the FAA, to which they responded with no objection to those standards. They had some concerns, but we've addressed those concerns, and worked through several City Council workshops with yourselves, along with the Airport Advisory Board. However, airport staff and the Airport Advisory Board are on completely two different spectrums and opposing views on changing the minimum standards. To that end, the Chairman of the Airport Advisory Board recommend that we bring in Mr. Jeff Coleman from the Aviation Management Consulting Group. And Jeff is here. He brings with him over 25 years of general aviation industry experience in both FBO management and general aviation management consulting. He received a bachelor's degree in aviation business administration from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach. He's an active aircraft owner and a private pilot, resides in Denver, Colorado. And without further ado, Jeff Coleman.
Thank you, Matt. Commission, staff, community members, appreciate this opportunity. I always hate this setup, so I apologize in advance. My back is to you, since I've got the podium up here. And I've got my clock stopped, so make sure we don't go too far. I want to provide you plenty of time to ask some questions. I understand we have about an hour and a half to go through this, so I'm going to try to keep my formal comments to about an hour. But I do encourage you, as I've entitled this, a short course, I would like this to be interactive. We can be interactive during my dialogue, so feel free to stop me, ask me some questions as we're going along, or if you want to save your questions towards the end, whichever works best for you. I have provided for you at each of your seats the PowerPoint presentation that I'm going to be going through here, just so you can follow along, and also so you don't have to take as many notes, because a lot of my comments are collected there in the PowerPoint. I'm not going to go over my background other than to say I've grown up in general aviation. I live and breathe general aviation, and that's really what our firm does. We focus solely on general aviation issues. We work with airports on a wide variety of issues, primary guiding documents probably being one of our core services that we do for airports. We also work with, I'm supposed to be clicking this button too. Go on here. We also work a lot with aviation businesses, both fixed base operators and specialized aviation service operators. We work with associations and ATA and BAA and AOPA, a lot of eight state agencies as well. So we have a wide variety of clientele, but again, our services is focused solely on general aviation. That's what we know well, that's what we do well, and so we've tried to keep staying over the plate. Our topic today of minimum standards fits into sort of a broader area called primary guiding documents, which I'll talk more about what that consists of. But I wanted you to know that my comments today, while we work with FBOs and we work with airports, we work with customers at airports, so we come from a lot of different perspectives. My comments today are really based upon a day and a half, not a short course, but a long course, that we do for airport managers, airport sponsor members, attorneys, for the American Association of Airport Executives. We've been doing that for about 15 years, and so that's really what today's presentation is based upon. Also, we've probably done well over 70 different primary guiding documents at airports across the country over the last 20 years. So we do this work a lot. Want to start off with really the foundation of airport management, airport sponsor obligations, and several of these airport sponsor assurances really becomes the foundation for your minimum standards. Some of you may know a lot about these airport sponsor assurances, but for those that don't, when an airport receives money from the FAA through the Airport Improvement Program, you sign a grant document. It's basically an agreement with the FAA, and attached to that grant document are what is called airport sponsor assurances, and there's 39 of them, and you as an airport sponsor are obligated to maintain compliance with those assurances to remain eligible for future funding. If you don't, there is the potential of losing that future funding going forward. It can either be through self-action of the FAA coming in through an inspection process, which is fairly rare, or through a complaint process, which is usually undertaken by a user of the airport, a tenant of the airport, that doesn't feel that the airport as airport sponsor is maintaining compliance. They ask the FAA to investigate that and rule whether or not they are, and if they aren't, then the FAA takes certain actions. And usually that action is, hey, airport, get back in compliance. We'll help you get in compliance. Worst case scenario, which is very rare through the process, is where they actually remove the eligibility for future funding. There's a lot of guidance that the FAA gives in helping maintain compliance with the airport sponsor assurances, and I'll be talking a little bit about those as we go forward. There's a few slides there, and I'm not going to touch on every single one of the 39 assurances, which is what we do more in our long course. There's really two of them that I'd like to touch on today. And if you go to the slides that sort of at the end of the list is the first one, is moving along, economic non-discrimination. This is Airport Sponsor Assurance 22. I guess I'm hitting the wrong thing, I'm not following here. You might wanna keep up with me there, I apologize. I got two screens here, I'm doing my iPad so I know what to say, and I keep forgetting to hit the mouse on the left, my apologies. So economic non-discrimination, let me just read briefly what it says through the FAA. Sponsor will make its airport available as an airport for public use on reasonable terms and without unjust discrimination to all types, kinds, and classes of aeronautical use. Unjust discrimination. Those are really important words to understand. I always ask airport managers, may you discriminate? And the quick answer, which is reasonable to assume, is no, I cannot discriminate. You may discriminate. That's why they use the words unjust. You may not unjustly discriminate, but you may discriminate. Not all people, not all companies, not all activities are the same. So you may discriminate depending upon the situation, but not just unjustly. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go forward. Each commercial aeronautical activity shall be subject to the same rents, fees, rentals, and other charges as are uniformly applicable to all other such operators making the same or similar, there you go, same or similar uses of the airport and utilizing the same or similar facilities. Now, commonly what happens, we'll get hung up on those first words, be subject to the same. So then the word after same comes equal. You know, we need to be, everyone needs to be treated equally. And that's not really the case. You've got to look at the last part of this sentence. Same or similar uses, same or similar facilities. It's very unlikely that at an airport that the facilities are exactly equal. It's very unlikely that the land that is being used is exactly equal, whether it's airside access or landside access. The activities, the services, whether commercial or non-commercial, that are being provided are very rarely the same, but they may be similar. And so it takes a little bit of time and science to really determine how you treat your tenants, whether commercial or non-commercial, to make sure that you are not unjustly discriminating between those different types of operators. These are really becomes the foundations for minimum standards. It's a tool that you use as policy to help to make sure that those that are providing same or similar services, a fixed-base operator, what do you want them to provide as the type, level, and quality of products, services, and facilities? It helps bring people together sort of under the same umbrella and allows you to not unjustly discriminate those activities that are being provided at your airport. Moving along, each commercial aeronautical activity shall furnish services on a reasonable and not unjustly discriminatory basis to all airport users. Just as you as the airport sponsor are required to adhere to the airport sponsor assurances, there are a few of those sponsor assurances that your tenants are required to adhere to as well. And you actually, through your grant assurances, there are some clauses that you're required to put into their lease agreements that holds them to them through a contractual arrangement, those sponsor assurances. So while you may not unjustly discriminate to your tenants, fixed-base operators, specialized aviation service operators may not unjustly discriminate to their customers. So while it happens, you know, there is reality out there as well, but if I was running a fixed-base operator and I had a friend, I could not give him a special price. If he has a 172 and he buys, you know, a certain amount of fuel each year, and someone that comes off the street, same, buys the same amount of fuel, don't know them, I have to treat them same or similarly and may not unjustly discriminate. Now, what is discrimination? If I have a Gulfstream that comes in, you know, buys a 3,000 gallon load, and I have a Cessna 208 that buys 50 gallons, you know, they're both buying fuel, jet fuel, but they aren't same or similar. You may discriminate based upon volume, whether it's a one-time purchase or an annual purchase. So there are ways to differentiate pricing, but you can't just do it to your neighbor and your friend. If they're same or similarly situated, you may not unjustly discriminate. Sponsor may establish reasonable and not unjustly discriminatory conditions to be met by all users of the airport as may be necessary for the safe and efficient operation of the airport. What do you think we're talking about there? Minimum standards. That's what that's calling out right there. And beyond minimum standards, other policy documents of your airport. The FAA is encouraging you to establish reasonable and not unjustly discriminatory conditions to be met by users. Users are going to be commercial or non-commercial, and we'll talk about the role of minimum standards in a moment, for the safe and efficient operation of the airport. And that's really what you need to keep in mind as you're developing leasing policies, rules, minimum standards, safe and efficient operation of your airport. So let's go to the last assurance that we're going to talk about, and that's exclusive rights, which is also very key and critical when we're talking about minimum standards. So let me again read, and I apologize, but some of these words are very key that the FAA has put in these assurances, so that's why I want to make sure that I get them exact as the FAA has them. Sponsor will permit no exclusive right for the use of the airport by any person providing or intending to provide aeronautical services to the public. So the FAA doesn't want you to preclude, and let's go to actually the next slide of what the definition of exclusive right is. Any power, privilege, or right excluding or debarring another from enjoying or exercising a like power, privilege, or right.
excluding. So one of the misconceived notions about exclusive right is, I've got two FBOs, I have no problem. I'm not gonna violate my exclusive rights. You aren't safe. If you have five FBOs, it doesn't matter, you still may violate your exclusive right if you debar number six. It's about debarring anyone from operating on your airport as long as they meet your reasonable terms to engage in those activities. If you say no to someone that's willing to meet your reasonable terms, then you in essence are granting an exclusive right to one or more operators on the airport. So exclusive doesn't really mean one, it means debarring anyone from engaging activities at your airport. And sort of as I just described how is an exclusive right conferred, you could actually, certainly advise you not to, put it in an agreement. You know, you could actually say, you have the exclusive right to provide FBO services, to provide charter services, flight training. That's obviously the most obvious way of doing it, and certainly not the most advisable way of doing it. You could set unreasonable terms, conditions to debar others. Your minimum, and this again goes back to minimum standards. You could set your minimum standards so high that it really is unreasonable for someone else to come onto your airport and engage in an activity. That is an sort of an indirect way to grant someone an exclusive right indirectly. There's a lot of other means of doing that, and the key point there on the bottom of that slide is that it may be conferred on one or more parties. Why does the FAA really focus on this exclusive rights? And this is probably one of the areas, these two assurances, if you go through the list of complaints that the FAA receives on airports, assurance 22 and 23 are probably the most common assurances that are alleged to be violated. They don't want to restrict the opportunity for aeronautical activities on a federally funded airport. They don't want to limit the usefulness. The FAA, the federal government, invests a lot of monies on airports, and I know Ocala has received a lot of AIP monies over the years. The FAA wants to protect the use of those monies for a variety of uses. They don't want to deprive the public of the benefit of competitive commercial enterprise. And we'll come back to that competitive commercial enterprise, because the FAA does encourage it. But the FAA is also smart. They also understand that, you know, airports only have viability for some. And that, again, is why they encourage airports to establish minimum standards. And we'll talk about how you use those minimum standards as a tool to help protect not your tenants, but the type, level, and quality of the products, services, and facilities that you as the airport sponsor want to have at the airport. So those are the assurances. Let me pause for a moment if there's any questions on airport sponsor assurances.
Any questions?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So let's talk about primary guiding documents just briefly, which minimum standards is one of them. These are really the compendium of documents that you as the airport sponsor govern the operation, management, and development of the airport. There's a lot of documents that could go outside of this diagram that I'm going to offer up here, but these are the what we call primary guiding documents. Your leasing, rents, and fees policy. If you don't have one, we encourage you to have a policy that helps establish the process to lease land and improvements at your airport. It helps set rents and fees and term for land and improvements at your airport. It helps put a process together for adjusting those rents and fees on a fixed process. Again, if you have a policy and it's not done on a reactionary basis, you are more likely to maintain compliance with your airport sponsor assurances by acting through policy versus acting through politics, which every airport has politics, acting through individual desires. But if you set up a policy that is designed to help you achieve the mission and vision of your airport, then you're more likely to stay compliant with your airport sponsor assurances. But most importantly, you're more likely to achieve your mission and values. Minimum standards, which we're going to talk about, rules and regulations, and development guidelines. As you can see, I've got sort of four circles there under each document, and they each have a role on how you manage and operate your airport. The leasing, rents, and fees policy has to do with occupying land and improvements. The minimum standards has to do with engaging in commercial aeronautical activities. Rules and regulations has to do with use of your airport, whether it's vehicles, aircraft, or people. And development guidelines has to do with developing infrastructure, improvements, hangars, parking lots, landscaping. I commonly will describe a development guidelines like a CC&R in a homeowners association, sort of governs what you can do with your home, sort of what development guidelines do as well. Helps your airport really have a more common visual theme. Make sure that it is developed in a methodical way and not sort of a hodgepodge of hangars and developments, and it just doesn't look like a planned development. Those are what your primary guiding documents are, and there's really a wide variety, depending upon each document, the value and the purpose of these. They're designed to contribute to the financial health of the airport. I would say your leasing, rents, and fees policy and your minimum standards help with that. Facilitate orderly development. Certainly, development guidelines, minimum standards, and leasing policy will do there. Promote the provision of quality product, services, and facilities, primarily minimum standards. Protect the health, safety, interest, and general welfare of the public, primarily your rules. Reduce the potential conflict with lessees, consumers, and users. That's going to be all four of the documents that will help you stay compliant and avoid a potential Part 13 or Part 16 complaint, whether from an existing tenant or user or a prospective tenant or user. It really set the stage for how you're going to do business in the future. One of the things that we encourage our airport clients and in our class is to develop these documents not through a reaction, but through a process. Don't wait until you need them. Plan ahead and implement them in advance. While it's not uncommon, and I know in Matt's comments that one of the things that have triggered this is a proposal to develop an FBO, and now we're looking at the minimum standards. That happens a lot. But it's best not to do minimum standards at that point in time, because now it can be perceived that it's designed to meet just the needs of the applicant versus the needs of the airport.
But that's so, what it is for.
And it's very common. Absolutely. It's very common at airports. That's what triggers the process. Right. And sometimes you can't avoid it.
Mr. McLeod.
Can you restate that again? It's best not to.
It's best not to adopt or revise your minimum standards as a reaction to an application. We realize, and it's more common than not, that that happens, because lots of times these types of issues get pushed to the back burner until a necessity triggers it, which an application by a tenant many times does. But whether the standards get changed to the benefit, whether on purpose or not, or to the detriment of the applicant or the existing tenant, there can be a perception that these minimum standards are being designed to protect the on-airport interest or being designed to protect the applicant. And it's hard to avoid that perception when they're being done at the same time. Okay. And that's why we always encourage the airports on a regular cycle. We always say 5 years. Review your minimum standards every 5 years. Do they meet your airport environment? If they don't, then revise them at that point. Yes.
And you know, to Councilman McLeod's comment and your comment, perception is reality, and that's exactly why we're doing what we're doing. Your advice, it sounds like, is not to do or reduce the minimum standards at this time. So I mean, we can just all fold our papers up and just all get back to work and go home. I mean, because that's what we're here about, is reduce the minimum standards so another FBO can come in.
Best world example is to not do them based upon application. But reality is that you may need to. Now, you need to even be more careful at this time to make sure that the process, and we'll talk about process of revising minimum standards, are thoughtful and not only related to the reaction of an application, but is really more focused on what does this airport need in the type, level, and quality of product, services, and facilities. While the application might be triggering at this time, try to take that, try to set that aside and really focus more on the airport as a whole and not the application through the process of revising the minimum standards.
Mr. McLeod.
So, perfect world, we don't have an application right now. And,
right.
You know, we should review these standards every 5 years?
About every 5 years. Probably more times than not, minimum standards probably only need adjusted about every 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we live in a very cyclical industry. And we've been, you know, I've been in the industry almost 30 years. And I've gone through probably about 3 major cycles, 2 very significant cycles. And if you just go 5 years ago, here at this airport and every airport across the country, it was a very different environment. And if you had established minimum standards in 2006 or 7, and reviewing them today, 5 years later, it very well may need to adjust because the economies have adjusted dramatically. But again, cycles in our industry are typically about 10 years apart. So, you know, really, minimum standards probably need big adjustments every 10 years, but they should be looked at every 5 years just in case it needs a little tweaking here and there. Not based upon, you know, applications, not based upon existing tenants, but what does you as the airport sponsor want to assure is the type, level, and quality of product, services, and facilities at the airports? And I'll talk more about that when I get right into minimum standards, because that's really the key about minimum standards.
I would like to, before we go any further, just to draw your attention to the summary that was provided to us. You can see back in 05, Mr. Groh was talking about changes to the minimum standard and continued through from that date to this. And so this is not something that's being brought up, I wouldn't say necessarily for a specific developer, but has been an ongoing discussion since at least 05 when it's been documented.
That's good.
Thank you.
Thank you. So beyond serving the intended purpose, these documents need to be consistent with, as I talked about earlier, airport sponsor assurances. There's a vast majority of regulatory measures that you need to remain compliant with. And there's other compliance-related directives that the FAA provides. Policies, orders, 5196B, which is the airport compliance handbook, and a couple advisory circulars, one on exclusive rights, which goes into a lot more depth than I provided earlier today, and one on minimum standards. I've actually provided at the back of everyone's handout there for your benefit, I've attached all 39 airport sponsor assurances as a separate handout. I've attached the 2 advisory circulars that I just spoke about, AC 5196 and 5197, so that for your benefit and nightly reading if you so choose. I did not attach 5196B, which is a very important document, but it's 700 pages. That's available online, but I did not attach that to your document. I'm sure as I have, Matt has just loved reading that new document. So let's get into the meat of what we really wanted to talk about. You know, my first 25 minutes there was really designed to give you a foundation of, you know, why we need to have minimum standards, the FAA's role in this. And then one of the things that I did not mention about the FAA is that, unfortunately, the FAA does not require you to have minimum standards. They do encourage you to have minimum standards, and that is said throughout many documents. The other sad thing is that while you may submit your minimum standards to the FAA for review, they do not approve your minimum standards or any other policy documents that you may provide them. The letter that you will get back from them comes in many forms, but the typical comments is that it's a letter of, forget what the word is now, but basically they just have no objection. Letter of non-objection is basically what they say. There's only one time that you will find out if your minimum standards truly comply with the airport sponsor assurances, and that is if someone files a complaint. and it goes to the FAA. And then that is when they will absolutely tell you whether or not. And that, again, is an important reason to be very thoughtful through your process of developing policy documents, including minimum standards, to try to the best of your ability with the assistance of the FAA, because they will provide you assistance and they will provide comments on your minimum standards, but they won't approve them. But it's important process, and I'll talk more about that. So focusing on minimum standards. Minimum standards are designed, are requirements to be met as a condition for the right to conduct a commercial aeronautical activity at your airport. Doesn't have anything to do with non-commercial activities. It's all focused on commercial aeronautical activities, whether from a fixed base operator, which commonly is going to be selling fuel, doing real estate, and doing some other aeronautical activities in conjunction with that. You really set that standard of what you want them to do in addition. Or some specialized aviation service operators. And those typically are people not doing fuel. They can do one or more of these specialized activities: flight training, aircraft maintenance, charter, aircraft storage, avionics, the list goes on. There's a wide variety. And depending upon the types of activities that are occurring at your airport today or that you anticipate in a reasonably short term, probably that 5-year window, then you would want to make sure that you adopt some minimum standards to help govern those activities that are going to occur at your airport. Why do we do minimum standards? And we've talked about this. One, you want to provide a reasonable opportunity without unlawful, really should say unjust discrimination, to applicants to qualify. Key word, qualify, and I'll circle back on that in a moment. To compete, well, I'll talk about that word too, to occupy land and improvements and engage in authorized aeronautical activities. So let's talk about qualify for a moment. You as the airport sponsor are allowed to set the bar on the type of operators that you wish to have operating at your airport. You may set experience requirements that you want, because of the type of customers you have, you may want a certain amount of experience of management team. Can't really always put it on the ownership team because, you know, owners, you know, own different types of business, but you may want to have a management team with a certain level of experience depending upon the type of activity being provided. To compete, you may or may not go through a competitive process. You are not required by the FAA to utilize an RFP process. We encourage you through your leasing policy to sort of stipulate what will or will not trigger an RFP process to compete for an opportunity at an airport. But the key is that you're not required to. We encourage, if more than one party is interested in a single opportunity, that you utilize an RFP process to identify the most qualified party, going back to the qualify and the quality, to make sure that you are getting the best type, level, and quality of product, services, and facilities at your airport. Consistent threshold. That's probably one of the key tools that minimum standards provide you, is a consistent threshold. That allows so that you are not unjustly discriminating. You're treating everyone, and I'm not going to say equally, because you don't have to treat everyone equally, but you're all treating them consistent with your minimum standards. That's real important, is a consistent threshold requirement being established through the minimum standards, leveling the playing field and promoting fair competition. So let's talk about leveling the playing field, because that's also, you know, people think, well, we have to be equal. Everyone has to be the same. It's not really what that is saying. I sort of try to equate minimum standards to a poker game. And when we all sit around the table, whoever is the dealer or whoever is the house will stipulate what the ante is. You know, it's a minimum ante to start playing the game. And as the game progresses, players can up the, you know, they can raise. Well, that's fine, but everyone has to start at the same point. That's your minimum standard. If someone wants to build more hangar space or lease more land greater than what the minimum standards are, that's fine. But you don't have to require the next person that wants to be an FBO to have the same amount of land, the same amount of hangar space as the existing operator. They just need to meet that minimum standard that you establish as the airport sponsor. And the key is, well, how do I set that minimum standard? What criteria do I use to set that minimum standard? And we'll talk about that. So what's in minimum standards? They're the general requirements that, you know, govern all commercial aeronautical activity use of the airport. There typically is a separate fixed base operator section. There is a specialized aviation service operator section, which breaks down into the long list of different types of activities that I talked about earlier. And then the permit. And we'll talk about the permit process. I'm really not going to go through each one of these general requirements. I've provided more, almost a little bit of a checklist for you as you're looking at your minimum standards to make sure you're addressing some of these key areas that are commonly at issue when someone's engaging in commercial aeronautical activities at an airport. So it's just important. And if there's any questions about, you know, certain ones, I'll be glad to talk about those. But again, that's for the long course. And if you're interested, we're teaching in Reno, Nevada at the end of June, the long course on primary guiding documents. So fixed base operator, let's focus on that for a moment. And again, long list of different things that you want to make sure you establish. But really the question that you need to be asking yourself is, where do I set it? What do I use as a guide to establish minimum standards? Well, the first guide is the first word of the document, minimum. These are minimum standards. These are not maximum standards, they are minimum standards. Now, minimum standards does not mean minimal. These are the minimum standards that you as the airport sponsor want to set to maintain the type, level, and quality of aviation products, services, and facilities you have at your airport. Does that mean it should be based upon what your existing FBO has at the airport? No. Should it be looked at and used as a guide? Absolutely. You can't ignore it. It is reality. It is there. But is that where you set the bar? No. The best way I like to describe is almost if you had a clean sheet of paper, but you had all these customers. Clean sheet of paper was, you know, no one's providing services at your airport today, but you have all of these base customers, you have all of these transient customers that utilize your airport. Where do you want to set the bar so that the type, level, and quality of product, services, and facilities is being met by the existing level of demand out there at your airport today? Where do you need that bar? Because lots of times we'll talk to clients, whether they have zero FBOs, one FBO, two FBOs, it really doesn't matter. They say, well, we want to make sure we set the bar so we have competition. That's really not a good mechanism to use minimum standards for, is to create competition. It should be designed to make sure that you have the type, level, and quality of product, service, and facilities at your airport. The market will take care of competition. The interesting fact that a lot of people don't understand is that at 90% of airports, let me qualify airports, 3,000 foot paved runway or more. There's a lot of airports out there, but airports with about a 3,000 foot paved runway, there's about 3,500 of them. 90% of those airports only have one FBO across the country. So lots of times I'll hear from airport management, airport sponsors, you know, competition is good, competition is normal. I'm not going to argue with either one of those statements, but competition on an airport in the fixed base operator environment when only 90% have one, and let me qualify that as well, one or less. There's probably about 30% of those 90% that don't have any FBOs, there's zero. About 30% of those are operated by the airport sponsor, primarily because the airport can't sustain a viable private enterprise. So only about 10% of airports have two or more FBOs. So competition is normal, but it's not always on the airport. You will find in talking with aircraft owners and operators, which I'm one of them, And believe me, when I'm flying my plane through the system, I'm making decisions on where to buy my fuel. And I will stop at another airport en route to buy fuel, and I'll base it upon price many times. Sometimes I'll base it upon service. Sometimes I'll base it upon a restaurant at an airport. So there's a lot of different decision factors that go into where I buy fuel en route. And if I'm going into a metropolitan area, where am I going to land in that metropolitan area based upon some different criteria? Lots of times it's proximity to your final destination. That dictates ultimately. And Ocala, my understanding is, again, I have not done a market assessment here, but just having done a lot of work in the Florida area and especially up this corridor, Ocala is to a certain degree a fair amount of a destination market. They're coming here for a reason. There's some that are going to stop, on the way. You have a restaurant here, and hopefully that draws some traffic. I don't know, but hopefully it does. Let's see. We were talking about competition. Normal competition is good. Competition is good, no doubt about it. And most of that competition is going to come off your airport. But we have seen quite a bit of consolidation in our industry. If you go back to the 80s or so, there was probably about 4,000, 4,500 FBOs across this country. Today we've got about 3,500 FBOs across this country, both public and privately owned. There's been a fair amount of consolidation. And during this economic downturn that we've had over these last couple, 2.5, 3 years, there's been quite a bit more consolidation. We've been seeing more go from 2 to 1 or 3 to 2 than we've seen go 1 to 2. I think a real good example not too far from here is Destin, Florida. They had a one FBO airport for a number of years, went to a second FBO probably about 4 years ago. It was, during the strong days, a little over a million gallon market, now down, I think 700, 800,000 gallons, now divided amongst two operators. The original operator there, it has been losing money for the last 4 or 5 years, ever since competition came on the airport. Owned by three people, and they've been trying to sell it and been having a very difficult time doing that, except for maybe, I'm sure that the existing operator might want to do it, but sometimes there's ill will when you get this competition. You may not really want to sell to your competition there. But that's a story that we see a lot around airports. I encourage you to, evaluate your market potential. But most importantly, going back to my original comments, what is the type, level, and quality of products, services, and facilities you want to have offered to your based and transient customers? That's the bar. That's where you should set your minimum standards through your process. So let's talk about process. And I'm going to skip through a few slides here because a few of those slides there are more about, what's in your minimum standards. Be glad to circle back and speak more on, each step, all the different criteria. You cover a lot of those in your minimum standards. The biggest question lots of times, where do I set the bar? What process should I utilize for that bar? So I'm going to, I'm going to pause. I'm going to go to General Aviation Permit. He's there. We do encourage you, if you don't already, to utilize a General Aviation Permit at your airport for those engaging in commercial aeronautical activities. And the reason why we encourage you to do this is that you, as the airport sponsor, should have a direct relationship with anyone on your airport providing a commercial aeronautical activity. Because a lot of services are provided through a sublease agreement where you have a master tenant, whether it's the FBO or some other developer, where they have the contractual lease agreement through a sublease, you may approve that sublease agreement, but you don't have that direct relationship. We encourage you through your minimum standards is to establish a general aviation permit. So anyone, whether they're leasing land and improvements on the airport directly through you or through a sublease, or in today's day and age, there's more and more providers of services that don't even operate off of your airport. They may come on the airport. Aircraft washing is a perfect example of that. Lots of times people will come onto the airport to wash aircraft. Someone that needs to provide specialized aircraft maintenance. There are some unique airplanes out there, and I know you have aircraft maintenance on your airport today, and that's great. It's not, unfortunately, it's not the most common thing. Those types of small shops have gone to the wayside. And so anything you can do to protect, I put that in quotes, because you're protecting the type, level, and quality of products and services, you're not protecting entities. And anything you can do to protect the delivery of that service at your airport is important. But there are some unique aircraft, probably on your airport, as many airports, that aircraft maintenance shop is just unable to maintain. And I don't know what services they provide, so I'm talking sort of in general here. A radial engine, okay? They may not be able to provide maintenance services for a radial engine. Fabric exterior, a unique jet engine from Russia. You know, there are these unique planes out there in our industry that a basic aircraft maintenance shop may not be able to maintain. So it would be appropriate to allow someone to come on the airport and provide maintenance for those aircraft owners so that they can obviously keep their plane airworthy and fly. But you want to have a relationship with anyone that comes on your airport. You want to protect your users, and through that permit process, you're making sure that they're qualified, you know, they have the proper certifications, that they have insurance, because if you allow someone to engage in commercial aeronautical services on your airport and they don't have insurance, and I'm repeating a lawsuit, but I'm not going to say when and where, and that person crashes, the estate tries to go after the person that was doing the maintenance and they have no insurance and they have no estate, where are they going to turn to next? The next deepest pocket, and that's going to be the airport sponsor, because they allowed that activity to take place on the airport. So we encourage this general aviation permit for anyone engaging in commercial aeronautical activities. So the last step in the process, the development process. And I would say this is the most important part of developing minimum standards. One of the things in our class is we talk about process, process, process. It really doesn't matter what the end document is if you didn't utilize a good process to get there. Did that process help you measure the balance of airport sponsor assurances as you were developing these and the importance of those and maintaining compliance with the FAA? Did you measure the demand for product, services, and facilities at your airport through a process? You know, what do we need to have here? Did we involve the stakeholders? Did we solicit input from them, both on airport and off airport? Did we consult resources and references? And I think, and I know this is an ongoing process, I think, you know, having us here today, and I didn't say at the beginning, I don't think, I appreciate you involving us in your process and hope that this will help you, give you some information, give you some tools as you move forward. Utilize a structured development process. Sort of spell that out in the beginning. How are we going to go about this? You know, who are we going to involve? What process are we going to use? What timeline? Because if you don't establish a timeline, it will drag out. These processes tend to anyway, but especially if you don't have a structured timeline, this is when drafts are going to be available for review, this is how long you have to review, this is our target approval date. You at least have that as a structure that will help you move forward. And conducting a comprehensive inventory. And I'll talk more about the inventory. But going back again about mission and vision, you know, what is your vision for the airport? What do you want to be when you grow up? You know, people always say, can you give me an example of a good vision? And the two examples I think are the best because they're measurable and they're lofty. AT&T, if you go way, way back, a phone in every home. That was their vision. This is before a phone went in every pocket. You know, that was a long time ago. NASA, you know, put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. You know, that was their vision when they started out. Those are great examples of vision. Measurable, but lofty. And you want them lofty, but you want them reachable. What are your goals and objectives? Have you gone through a business planning process? You know, what are some of the goals and objectives you have for your airport from an infrastructure standpoint, from a product, services, and facilities standpoint? Who's going to take the lead in developing facilities and infrastructure at your airport? those are some of the goals and objectives that I encourage airports to go through prior to developing minimum standards. Don't let minimum standards drive your mission and vision or your goals and objectives. Have your mission, vision, goals, and objectives drive your minimum standards. Making sure you review any existing policies or guiding documents that you already have existing. Lots of times, and it's not unique to airports, airports, you know, do tend to be reactionary. They do tend to send out a memo and, you know, sort of set policy by memo, by letter. That those tend to go out, you know, ever so often. It's important to try to go back in history and collect some of those and use some of that history in helping set your policy going forward. Most importantly, as I've repeated several times today, you know, what is the type, infrastructure, products, services, and facilities at your airport today? Where do you want them to be tomorrow? That's your vision. And what, at a minimum, to meet the demand of your existing base and transient customers, where do you want that to be? You certainly have to look at the history of your based aircraft, your aircraft operations, and your fuel volumes. That many times will be some good economic indicators to you of what your market can support in type, level, and quality of products and facilities. You certainly don't want to require a 30,000 square foot terminal building when your market can only support 5 or 10. So it's important to, you know, do some measurement of what you can. You don't want to require, you know, go down to Fort Lauderdale Executive. You know, one of their many FBOs down there has 1 million square feet in hangar space. 1 million square feet, as Banyan. But certainly, you don't want to, and if that airport was going through minimum standards, they wouldn't want to set their bar at 1 million. You know, again, Banyan raised through the process. But you want to figure out what your airport can support. You want to look at your master plan, and I understand they're going through a master planning process as we speak. That's a very important process to helping you through your minimum standards, because that will help sort of, that's part of that visionary process. You know, what are we going to be 10, 15, 20 years down the road? And certainly looking at the financial and economic aspects of your airport. What are your rents and fees? Can another FBO support, you know, their private enterprise with the rents and fees? One of the things we encourage you to require through the minimum standards process is the application process. And whether you're going through an RFP process or it's a separate application, you know, someone just unsolicited brings to you, we encourage you as the airport sponsor, through your fiduciary responsibilities, is to make sure that they are proposing a viable business enterprise in your airport for two reasons. The first primary reason is, are they going to be able to pay your rents and fees? Can the business enterprise, not the owners, not the investors, but can the business enterprise pay the rents and fees that are going to be owed to you? Can they complete the construction of improvements that they are proposing? And third, can they viably support their investment through a reasonable market share of the airport? What a business plan should tell you as the airport sponsor whether or not they can. And that is a reasonable criteria that goes back to that qualify, you know, can people qualify to operate in your airport? Well, the FAA says everyone has the right to go broke. It's hard to argue with what the FAA's perspective is. But they aren't telling you as the airport sponsor you have the right to go broke. They actually tell you through your airport sponsor assurances that you have to have a goal of financial self-sufficiency. And you do that by making sure that you're leasing land and improvements to entities that can afford through their business enterprise to pay the rents and fees. And that you won't end up having one FBO now having to absorb two FBOs. Harlingen, Texas is going through a big circle right now. Over the years, them and McAllen, Texas, they've gone back and forth from one FBO to two FBOs to one FBO to two FBOs to one FBO to two FBOs for 60 years, back and forth, because of the cycle of our industry. And right now, the single FBO through a very depressed market, you know, is supporting two FBO facilities. It's become very difficult for him, and he's asking the airport, yeah, I need help here. You know, I, as a favor, took on the second FBO facilities because you asked me to. But it's not always easy. So we encourage you to look at some of those dynamics. You can't ignore the external factors. Politics are involved at every level. And politics is not necessarily bad. You know, politics is just part of the process and needs to be factored in. But also, by adopting these policies, you eliminate some of the negative aspects of politics. You have policies that you as politicians agree that this is going to help us meet our mission and vision for the airport. And we're going to do this consistently, which is a key requirement of the FAA. We're going to do this consistently moving forward to meet those. But we take the right every 5-10 years to review these policies to make sure it's keeping us on track to meet our mission and vision and our goals and objectives. You got to look at the community. You got to look at the national, regional, and local marketplace. Make sure you do look beyond what's just happening to your base aircraft, your aircraft operations, and your fuel volumes. Make sure you go out and look at what's happening to the market around you, to the state, and the nation. Talked earlier about the process of input, making sure everyone on the airport has an opportunity, making sure people off the airport, that I talked about involving the FAA and reviewing the existing draft of minimum standards, very important. Making sure your lawyers also review those. Using committee groups, public meetings to make sure you get all the input, all important steps of the process. And I had talked earlier about inventory, you know, making sure that you take into the process what is at your airport today, you know, what is the existing type, level, and quality of product, service, and facilities, what does your FBO have, what does your SASOs have in vehicles and equipment, personnel, hours, insurance. Again, not to set the bar where they're at, but to use them as a guide in your decision-making process. Because really, the bar should be set. I know I've said this several times, but it's the important point. What is the type, level, and quality you as the airport sponsor want to have at your airport, regardless of the number of FBOs you have today or you want tomorrow? What is the product, services, and facilities you want to have for your base customers and your transient customers? And that should be the bar that you set. Mention the resources. I'm just sort of skipping here because I pretty much hit all these. We talked about the review and the update. I got to the point where I was just repeating a lot of stuff, so no point repeating again. Really want to give you all an opportunity to ask some questions, get into some dialogue, and
are there any questions for Mr. Coleman? Mr. Brower.
I have a couple questions for you. Is it possible to utilize the minimum standards to address fuel costs that the FBO might provide?
Usually that's not done through minimum standards. That's typically done through the lease agreement. And there's a lot of different ways to do it. It's not recommended that you put such tight constraints on fuel pricing because the lease agreement may not fully understand the operating dynamics of an FBO. Lately it's not been too bad insurance, but there was a time when insurance was just, you know, going through the roof. And that impacts your bottom line. And if you're constrained on margin or price, you may not be able to bring that in. But we've seen airports in the past that have, you know, put market dynamics on. You know, they've asked them to, they agree upon in advance what's considered a comparable airport. That's probably the most important thing, is making sure whether it's local, regional, or national, you know, what are comparable out there from a cost standpoint, from a market size standpoint, because that drives the viability of the business and where margins typically are. And so if you identify in advance and you agree upon, you know, these are our airports and you need to be within the bookends, or you need to be at the top 25 percentile, the middle 25 percentile, wherever it is. That's typically the most fair process that we've seen in establishing fuel pricing guidance It's not controlling the prices, it's just putting some bookends on it.
So if an airport is competing for customers, for airplanes, that competition is naturally going to drive the cost of the fuel, right?
Not the cost, but the sale price.
The sale price. Right. So you mentioned earlier that our airport's a destination airport. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, we're really not competing with anyone per se for flights to come into the airport. Could that be a driver for fuel costs to be generally higher than surrounding airports?
It can be, but again, aircraft operators, because if you look at the history of aviation, and I'm going to digress just for a moment and then circle back to help you answer that question, is that you charge a fuel flow chart at your, I assume, right, Matt?
Yes.
Okay. Which is very common at most general aviation airports. And it was a good tool to use a long time ago at general aviation airports. It's not so good today. The reason it's not is that back, 20, 30 years ago, regardless of the type of aircraft you use, you had to buy fuel. The performance and the fuel efficiency of aircraft was not so good 20, 30 years ago. And you basically had enough fuel to get to your destination. You had to buy fuel to get to your next destination or get home. Today, because of technology, fuel efficiency has gotten quite good. And so aircraft owners and operators many times are able to tanker fuel. And so you compete on price, even though it's a destination market, you're competing on price from the home airport, from where that plane came from, or the next destination, because they're able to skip fuel purchases. Now, FBOs have figured this out in the industry. Signature was the leader of this. Most FBO companies, whether chain or otherwise, have followed on, and they now have, they call them by a lot of different names, handling fees, ramp fees, whatever. So if you don't buy fuel, the FBO is charging a handling fee or a ramp fee, because a lot of planes don't buy fuel nowadays. Regardless of price, it's just because they have they have the best price at home typically. Airports, unfortunately, get sort of the short sheet, because you don't have really a mechanism in place to collect from those that are using your airport but not purchasing fuel. And regardless of where you push that price of fuel, whether through a lease agreement or not, you'll affect some of those purchasers, but there's still going to be a certain percentage that will not purchase fuel at your airport and hence will not pay a fuel flowage fee. So I do encourage you, through your leasing policy, which sets rents and fees, think about the mechanism that you collect from users of your airport, so that both those that purchase fuel and don't are funding the operation of the airport. But you also have to think about those dynamics in trying to help manage the price of fuel. Is that it will help. Pricing certainly is in the decision process of how much fuel someone buys. But many times, and I would encourage you maybe through a process of interviewing transient pilots that are coming to your airport, they have already decided, regardless of price, of how much fuel they need once they arrive at your airport and how much fuel they're going to need to get to their next destination. Sometimes it's calculated by their dispatch office long in advance, because they know the payload, they know the destination, they know the winds. And so price is a factor, absolutely. I can't argue that. But it's not the only factor in deciding how much fuel they're going to buy.
Last question I have is, we're coming to an end of a 30-year agreement in a couple of years with our FBO. Mm-hmm. In your experience, what is the general length of an agreement with an FBO?
Sure. That's a very good question. And there's been a lot of discussion and debate in the industry about that. If you had to say what's the norm out there, I'm not going to say a specific number. I'm going to give you a range, 20 to 30 years. But that's really driven by a single major factor, investment. When we help airports develop leasing policies, when we get to the term section, we encourage them that investment equals term. That's what drives how long you give them, how much are they going to invest. So you want to give them at least enough time to amortize out that investment. And sort of rule of thumb, at a minimum, 20 years. 20 years really doesn't quite give them truly enough, and that's why you sort of entice them, make some more and give them a gauge. Do this much and we'll give you 30, and you do it some more at a later point, give you another 5. But 20 to 30 is sort of the bookends of the normal term out there with reasonable investment. If someone's not making investment on your airport, and this is quite common, they invest and do a beautiful facility at your airport, they maintain it throughout the term of their 20-year agreement, they come up to the end, it's like, where do I mean, it's a beautiful facility. I don't need more hangar space. I don't need more this or that. So they don't have a place to invest. So there's a couple of different things that can be done. One is you basically give them another 5 to 10 years. So without investment, that's typically what we see is about a 5 to 10 year extension onto an agreement without investment. But they don't always have to invest in their own improvements. We actually, when we wrote the leasing policy for Van Nuys Airport in Van Nuys, California, it was the first time that we had written this in there, and we like the aspect of it. Because FBOs like term, you know, they like, it adds value to their business enterprise. So invest somewhere else on the airport. Invest in a roadway. You know, pay for an AIP grant for the airport. Help build something else that benefits the airport community, not necessarily their direct leasehold. Now, you know, they're going to have to do some math because lots of times those investments don't create revenue stream. All it's creating is term. But there's some math that can be done to find a simple balance.
Do a lot of airports identify what the expected investments are to be going into an agreement?
They should. A lot don't. And that is where lots of times airport sponsors will get into that unjust discrimination, because one party will come in and they'll do, you know, 10 million and they got 30, and another party will do 9 million and they only got 20. And it's like, well, wait a minute, that's only $1 million difference. Why did you make that decision? You know, if you have a structure in advance that says X to Y, and the safest way that we like to look at it is a investment per year per acre. So how much acreage you have and how much investment on a per dollar per acre gives you a per year sort of translates out. And you sort of have a minimum and a maximum of term that you would give. And you also have to keep in mind that you may have to have different schedules depending upon the type of operator. So for instance, an FBO, they're gonna have a lot more acreage because they have a larger apron area to take care of transient aircraft. And so their investment per acre for an FBO is gonna be lower than an investment per acre for a specialized aviation service operator like a aircraft maintenance facility. Because most of their investment is on a smaller parcel, 1 acre, 2 acres, and all of it's in a hangar, which, you know, $100 a square foot for a hangar versus apron that you're doing $5, $10 a square foot, depending upon asphalt, concrete. So you may have to have different formulas for an FBO versus a specialized aviation service operator.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Any other questions? Okay.
I'll just a comment. You told us two things. You mentioned that we shouldn't use minimum standards to create competition, correct?
Correct.
You also said we shouldn't use fuel costs to create minimum standards, or minimum standards to create the fuel cost or adjust
I think costs. In response to his question, you shouldn't address the management of fuel pricing through minimum standards. That's more
right,
of a lease.
That's what I meant.
That's okay. More of a lease agreement okay. A methodology.
Yeah, and for, you know, we're looking through these notes here. I mean, this has been going on for, you know, a number of years, same with Landmarks. You know, fuel prices are high, and we need to get another FBO in here, you know, give Landmarks some competition so that at the end of the lease, you know, they'll, you know, go away. I think they're a great partner. You know, we're getting close to the end of the lease. We're talking about building a first-class FBO. It seems to me that we shouldn't lower our minimum standards. You know, if there's enough, you know, if someone wants to come in and build an FBO and, you know, keep our minimum standards where they are, you know, so be it. I just don't think there's enough business there to have two, you know, FBOs competing with each other.
And let me add to that is just as much as I said you shouldn't draft minimum standards to create competition.
Right.
To maintain that exclusive right to compliance, you don't use minimum standards to protect existing operators. What you're protecting is the type, level, quality of product, services, and facilities. That's your focus.
Okay.
You can't protect entities. You can protect what you as the airport sponsor want to make sure is available at your airport.
Okay, I agree.
Mr. Owen.
In that vein, can I ask you, on the outside looking in, what is it you see we're doing?
From the outside, what do I see that you're doing?
Yeah.
I don't know if I have enough information to answer that. I mean, it appears only from a timing aspect, you know, I don't know from an intent aspect, but, you know, realizing that this has been going on for a number of years, but it's sort of coming to head at the time of this entity wanting to become an FBO at the airport. You also had an RFP process about a year ago too. You know, lots of times that's a really good time to be also looking at your minimum standards. Is, you know, unless the RFP was triggered by someone wanting to, which, you know, that happens lots of times too, but, you know, you should have all of your ducks in a row prior to your RFP process and know what your policies are regarding those commercial activities. And so I probably would have encouraged to make sure that this minimum standard issue was addressed and finalized prior to the RFP process versus now after the fact. There's a lot of reasons that, you know, that doesn't always work out. But, you know, I encourage any, whether it's you or other clients, whether they're the airports or the FBOs, you know, make sure these processes are done, you know, on a non-reactionary basis. And if they are triggered by a reaction, which again is normal, it's customary, it happens, that's fine. You know, you can't avoid it sometimes. Then that is where the process even becomes more important, to make sure that the perception of the purpose of these minimum standards are truly understood, that it's about the type, level, quality, product, service, facilities we want on the airport. Has nothing to do with our existing operator, has nothing to do with an existing applicant. It's where you really need to use the process so that it's a very clean process.
I mean, and so obviously the ultimate goal is a sustainable airport, an economic engine. I mean, everything that goes with that, so these minimum standards, as you talked about earlier, the non-discriminatory, it's really almost more towards, I hate to use the term generic, but just the goal is to have the airport up and running. The goal of the airport is to continue to be an economic tool. You know, we just had a big ribbon cutting out here, and we've got all this property out here, and we're trying to develop the airport. Mm-hmm. I continue to make sure that we're not writing rules and regulations to circle the wagons on what we've had for 100 years out there, or however long we've had, that we are moving forward, and that sometimes you've got to move on. So, and that's just where hopefully we can all get to, that we're, that the main goal is to have that an economic center, an economic hub out there that we can market to the world. And then having a document and rules and regulations and everything that you're talking about that would maintain that goal and not, separate to where we're writing rules and regulations to maintain history.
There's three ways to provide product, services, and facilities at your airport. And there's no right or wrong way. It's really, again, through the process, you have to decide what's right or wrong for you. There's one, which we had mentioned earlier about under the exclusive rights discussion, called proprietary exclusive rights. You, as the airport sponsor, has the right to provide product, services, and facilities at the airport. And that's the only time you can exclude others, is that if you're doing it with your people, your employees, and your equipment. Okay? And that does happen at airports. Most of the time, it's in situations where it's not financially viable for private enterprise. Most people in the industry, whether on the airport side or the FBO side, most people agree that private enterprise can most efficiently provide aviation product, services, and facilities in the airport for a variety of different reasons. The second way to provide it is through a management agreement, where the airport, you know, is really setting, you know, this is the type, level, and quality that we want, not just through minimum standards, but through a contract agreement telling someone. Then you really have control over pricing, because you, as the airport sponsor, own and operate the FBO, and you hire someone to manage it on your behalf. Yeah, and that's one way. You take the risks. You take the risks of the profit and the losses associated with that and any of the other customer service customer service issues. And that's sort of a public-private type partnership. The third, which is the most common in the industry, is truly just a private enterprise, which is what you have at your airport today, where you actually lease land and or improvements to a private enterprise, and they take the full risk of both the profits and the losses and the cyclical nature of our industry. I encourage somewhere in between actually the management agreement and the private land lease. And the best way I can describe that is a true public-private partnership. There are things that public agencies can do a lot better than private agencies. You have access to very cheap capital many times. So you can build aprons through AIP funds at used to be 95 cents on the dollar. Today it's now at 90 cents on the dollar, depending upon how your state helps out. You can many times finance construction of facilities or maybe get grant monies to help construct facilities. Those are huge benefits that airport sponsors has. And so I encourage both you as the airport sponsor and the private enterprise to find ways to work together to maximize the advantages, the efficiencies, and the benefits of both agencies to, again, achieve, I've repeated it several times, I'm sorry, but to maintain that type level quality of product, service, and facilities that you as the airport sponsor want to have. And it goes one step beyond what you want to have at the airport. It's what your customers need to have at the airport.
Any questions or comments? Thank you. I'm getting ready to call for public comments. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any public comments at this time? Come on up.
Terry Crawford, chair of the Ocala Airport Board. I apologize, but not it. It was kind of supposed to be a joint workshop or venture between the airport board. You got me, so that's what you got. In any event, I want to thank the council for taking the time and that. For taking the time and spending the money to bring Jeff here. I had originally stumbled upon him in the process and brought the information forth to all of you and didn't really even realize this was happening until it was already done. So thank you for that. Quickly, just from the standpoint, Matt's done an excellent job of working through and been working for a long time, ever since he came here. One of the first projects, I believe, if memory serves me correct, that we got involved in was minimum standards. They have been updated. They have been worked along. I think the last ones are 08. Is that the date we're working from now?
Yes.
08. So we're not really behind in that particular process. And we were working perhaps on those or whatever. Between the RFP process and the time that we did get the application from Ocala Jet, when we began this. So I really believe, and the airport board believes, and the airport board saw, and the feeling was that we were reacting to the application. It wasn't, this didn't happen. It happened as a result of the application. Now, just like Jeff said, that's neither here nor there, but it did at about the same time, and we saw that. The airport board feels strongly that the, and we voted on it two times, and we're somewhat close to the airport in terms of how it worked and what's supposed to happen, is that the airport minimum standards that we have now are not onerous. They're not really all that difficult. They could use some tweaking and so forth, but it's kind of like they're not broke. We don't really need to fix them right now. We fixed them as we've come along. And actually, the last discussion I had with the owner of Ocala Jet outside one of the meetings that we had, or with the Savolas, was that they were looking for really even a lowering of the minimum standards below what had been even discussed a little bit. So I think from the city's perspective and coming back to the quality of service is the issue. If you have a business who runs a facility like an FBO, if they make a reasonable profit and they provide really good service to the public and whatever sector it is, in this case the airport, I think that's the goal. That's what we as the airport board have as a goal. And I think the council does. And I'm really pleased today that Jeff came, because the airport sometimes, you look at it, I don't know what the overall capital investment is in the airport, but in one chunk of ground, it's probably the single most valuable piece of chunk of ground the city might own. There's a lot of infrastructure and a lot of money been put into that airport. It acts as the portal through which business comes and goes to our city. It's the first place the corporate folks that we want to come here to establish more and better and bigger industry, first place they see. So having all of that as a part of it is what the airport board has been working toward, what the city works toward, and so forth. So understanding better than I do today, I mean, I had an interest in the airport for a lot of years. Having and hearing some of what Jeff had to say relative to how other people do things and so forth, and getting a basis in the whole perspective of the whole country, I think was very helpful to me. I think good to the city. It was, I think, a time well spent from my standpoint. I wish more the airport board had been here, and I believe your standpoint in terms of understanding, a very significant portion of our city, and that is the airport. Budget's pretty good. One of the things that we are acting right now from what we see as a we're paying our way as we go and putting money in the bank, which is a little bit different in today's time. So the airport is very viable. And we're going to keep it that way, and we don't want to exclude service. We just want to make sure with 600,000 gallons of fuel, it's really difficult to divide that up among more than one operator and expect anything other than what might ensue in the way of competition, chaos, and a degradation of service. So, and it's hard to get a hold of that. You don't want to limit the competition, but at the same term point in time, when you bring the competition on, the pool of money that the operators have to work with is going to be diminished because they're going to sell fuel cheaper. Then where do you get in terms of the service you provide to the flying public? And I got to tell you, in all the years I've watched it, it goes back a long ways. Landmark, and I like Landmark, but I like Landmark, and I've stressed this many, many times. Not so much because they're a landmark. I like the landmark model or the type of FBO that they bring. A chain operator, we went looking for one of those. I was on the committee when we did it 20 years ago. We were looking for somebody rather than a standalone mom-and-pop kind of operation. I realize that's not what's being proposed by Kelly Jett, but we had a mom-and-pop operation, we got to this. On the other hand, you have the mom-and-pop operation, which is like Banyan, which he spoke to in Fort Lauderdale. And it's a unbelievable FBO, and there's four or five FBOs at the Fort Lauderdale Airport. So you can have that, but you got to have, I don't know how much fuel they pump, but, 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 million gallons, I would guess. And we're at 500,000, 600,000, 700,000. So, that's kind of the parameters that we've been working with in the airport board, and the kind of things that we look at, and the kind of consideration that we've had in terms of doing this. So Jeff coming today, bring us all up to speed in terms of what we're really looking for. I believe it's helpful. I think we need to go back and make a determination from the city's perspective, not just from the council of the airport. I live here. This is my city. I care an awful lot about it, whether it's the airport or whether it's public works or whether it's the county, or it doesn't really matter if it's the city or the county. Marion County is my home, has been for a long time. My business is here. I'm here for the good of the community. Regardless of where the community lands, border. And I think we need to look at that from the standpoint of the airport, the city council, airport board, the people who want to be here, and exactly what we want to have, and having folks like Jeff available to us, I think from the standpoint of leases and some of the other stuff we do, could be very handy in the future. So, do you have any questions of anything relative to what the airport board is doing?
Questions from Mr. Crawford.
Relative to all of this?
I just have a quick question. You had mentioned, if another FBO comes to Ocala and they get into, a competition with fuel prices, explain to me again how that's bad.
Well, if you only got 800, I've talked to several of you independently. It's like, okay, if I go down the street, I'm going to buy gas here. Mm-hmm. And if I don't like the price they got, I'll buy gas down there. And,
right.
In the aspect of driving your car around thousands of gas stations that work. Airports are a specialized entity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what Jeff was alluding to. people come here because they're coming here. The corporate people buy fuel because they're buying fuel because they're taking fuel or they're buying it somewhere else or whatever. I say all that just to say that the amount of fuel that we're going to sell at our airport, the number of gallons of fuel we're going to sell at our airport, is not going to be greatly changed by any of the things that we're doing here. A flight school coming here, a large corporation located here and having 20 airplanes, all of that's going to change the amount of fuel that we pump. But nothing much is going to change that. So over the years, and I've been involved with this thing a long time, we got close to 1 million gallons 1 year. That was when the fire tankers were here. We probably put 200,000 gallons of fuel in them. That was a number of years ago when all the forest fires were around, and we were doing that and, you know, pumping close to 1 million. So we've been at 800,000, maybe 700,000, 600,000 gallon airport for a long time.
So you don't feel that's basically not going to change. That's a fixed amount.
It's not fixed necessarily, but that's kind of where we've been historically. So airplane gas costs so much a gallon. They sell it for so much a gallon. In between, they have a gross margin that they work with. And all of the people that they hire, Landmark has, or those kind of FBOs here or anywhere else, are here 7 days a week from early in the morning till 8 or 9 o'clock at night. They got to pay people. You have a great level of service. So that's going to start, you know, as the profit goes down, there's not as much profit. They're not going to have as many people. They're not going to provide services in quite the same way, and, you know, the level of service would decrease.
Okay.
That's kind of where we're coming from.
So that's your way of thinking. Okay.
If you could expand the amount of fuel where you could be like, well, why do they only have 2, 3, or 4 million gallons? Oh, you could have, you know, then the world's your oyster.
So why do they have so much more than we do? Just because more people are going to Fort Lauderdale?
Money is the idea.
You know, so if we could get more people to come to Ocala, we would sell more fuel.
Yeah, but I don't want to turn it into Fort Lauderdale either. At the same point in time, I think the economics of Fort Lauderdale, and you look at that, and there's a lot of money in Fort Lauderdale.
Sure,
That's it.
Okay.
But that's it in a nutshell. It comes down to competition. I don't mind. In fact, you know, the Stavola people and Ocala Jet, I think they're very capable financially of doing what they want to do. But something's going to give when you get two of them there in the city. We can allow that to happen. There's nothing we can do, would really want to do to stop that. But I know when that happens, you're going to have a, you know, good competition.
Sure.
And it's, you know, now we've got 350,000 gallons divided amongst two. And you're going to have two people aren't doing quite as well. So the level of service to the airport user suffers at that point in time, in my opinion.
Okay. Thank you. Yes,
can I
please.
Ask that question as well?
Sure.
And I'll try to answer that question from a personal experience, but also an industry perspective, and not focus what's on Ocala, because I've not studied, you know, what's happening here. But it's what's here is pretty normal out there in the industry. When I got started in the aviation industry after graduating from Embry-Riddle, went to go work at Kaiser Air Oakland Jet Center in Oakland, California. Obviously a much bigger airport than Ocala, so not a perfect example, but it's the market effect is very similar. In our industry, sort of the general rule of thumb, you know, and obviously that general rule of thumb is going to be driven by the market mix, how much jet, how much avgas. It's also going to be driven by how much investment was made in a market, of how much fuel volume an FBO needs to have a reasonable profit and a reasonable return on investment. And generally, that number has been about 1 million gallons. That number has gone up a little bit over the last few years just because of the cost to invest in these and the operating cost. But going back, when I got started in this business, Oakland International Airport was about 1.6, 1.7 million gallons. And we had two FBOs. I was fortunate that I was with a very successful FBO. During my 6 years, the second FBO there, which included three national chains, had 14 general manager changes and three ownership changes until a point in time that, and the only reason that they just didn't go away is because they had a long-term lease. You know, they had an investment. And eventually, right about the time I was leaving is when we bought them out. And it went basically from a two FBO airport to a one FBO airport because it just could not sustain that second FBO, even though it was a well-funded, well-invested, still a business enterprise. Not until the airport reached about 4 or 5 million gallons did a second competitor come onto that airport and provide those services. And that became tough for my old employer, Kaiser Air, because they now had two FBO facilities that they were supporting because they bought out the second. And so now, in essence, we have three FBOs facilities on the airport, dividing a larger market, which is better. But lots of times what you'll see happen in a market that technically can't support, and I don't know whether, where that line for Ocala is, I don't know. I encourage you to do sort of that assessment, where is that line? But lots of times when competition comes onto an airport that can't support it, is that competition will survive typically till the end of one of the leases, and then you'll be back to a one FBO airport. That's what we commonly see. I could cite example after an example. Destin, Florida is going to be one of those. Many airports across the country that's happened at. I don't know if that's what will happen here at Ocala, but that's just experience from industry.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, Mr. Brower.
Actually, this question is for you, Matt. Can you give maybe just a brief overview of where staff stands on the changes to the minimum standards right now?
Right now, what we proposed is reducing the service requirements from specific four to maintenance plus any one of five different selections. And that was in an effort to not duplicate what we already have out there right now. We're already subsidizing one of our existing services, the avionics shop. We have some operators paying us an annual fee of close to $1,500 a year. The avionics shop is paying us $10 a year. So we're already subsidizing one service. So that's where we're at. That's what we were proposing with the new standards. As far as facility requirements and acreage and hangars and things like that, they were relatively similar between the existing standards and what we proposed.
Okay. I just want to kind of go over where we've been. We met in January, is that right, when we had the last workshop?
I believe so. It's been several times.
And at that workshop, council had given direction to go with the proposed minimum standards, and that was at that time maintenance plus any one. So the proposal has not changed from that day to this. Is that correct?
That has not changed. Correct.
Okay. And the existing standards that we have now, we are required four different services, and from this list that you've given us of several other airports, that appears to be the highest level of requirements of any of them. Is that correct?
Yes.
Destin has three. So, we're the only one that is requiring four different services. The other ones are three or less. Okay. So we're pretty stringent as far as that goes. And what you're recommending is maintenance plus one more, so that would be two, and it would be at their option what service they would provide. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions for that, Mr. Mayor Gordon?
Matt, where are we on getting a new FBO terminal? What's the next step in that? And that's one of the things we've been talking about for some time, whether doing it with Dumpy or Landmark or whoever it may be. Where are we on that?
Well, the state, FDOT, had programmed $2 million in grant funds over 3 years. The first set of funding was to be granted to Ocala before June of this year. An integral piece to that was our ability to match that $2 million. It's a 50-50 match. And we were counting on the American Fresh Farm deal to generate that revenue. But now that has been extended to essentially September, we had to negotiate with FDOT. We've actually been able to push back that terminal grant process a year. We've been able to fund it on the back end, so we're not losing that $2 million, but that process has been pushed back a year to try and parallel the American Fresh Farm deal. That is to say, the money that was to be granted to us this year didn't go away. We've been able to find a use for that, but instead of a 50-50 match, it's changed to an 80-20. We're going to actually come back to you next week with a grant agreement to do some work on our crosswind runway utilizing that funding. So we don't lose it. We're going to use it.
So the money we were going to use for an FBO, we're not going to use for an FBO. We're going to use it for a runway now, right?
Correct, but that has been pushed back a year, and it's programmed on the back end of that 3 year. So we're still pursuing the terminal grant. The grant funding for that, if we were to do it ourselves, is totally dependent on American Fresh Farms at this point. Okay. Otherwise, so we have to look at a public-private partnership.
So we're years away from ever getting a new FBO.
A couple years.
Yeah, I mean, you know how we work, you know, two, three, four years away.
Well, I don't know if it's that long. If American Fresh Farms begins turning dirt this fall, as we hope and anticipate they will, if you recall that arrangement was that the Water and Sewer Fund was going to advance the cash for the purchase of that property from the airport, and that money was then, of course, going to be leveraged for this grant to do it. So it could be within a year or two that we're well underway.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that would be nice, but I just don't see that happening, unfortunately, based on prior history. Anyway. Okay, thank you.
Anyone else have any comments or questions? Yes, please.
Good afternoon.
Could you give us your name and address?
My name is Justin Edwards, and my address, if you want, 217 Courtney Springs Circle in Winter Springs, Florida.
Okay.
My name's Justin Edwards. I actually represent the firm of Hoyle Tanner and Associates. I have with me today Doug Norman, the director of our office and an engineer. And I just wanted to come here and we heard this presentation was occurring and just talk to you quickly. I think Jeff did a great job explaining some of the issues that that come into play relating to the airport guiding documents and guiding principles. I thought it was important to just get up and mention that I have been an airport director myself, most recently in New Jersey, prior to that in Lakeland, Florida, and prior to that another facility in New Jersey, and these documents can actually benefit and help you. And I know that the FBO is obviously part of the controversy, let's say, at this point. But I think in the long run, these documents will actually insulate this board, the administration, the airport, and help set that level playing field that Mr. Coleman had discussed so much. So I just wanted to also say I attended a meeting with the Airport Advisory Board, or of the Advisory Board, last week. And I was really, really impressed, not only with my intelligence gathering and looking at the facility, but with the commitment by Director Groh and the Airport Advisory Board members just discussing these issues in detail. And I was very, very impressed. And you should all be proud, which I'm sure you are, of the spectacular facility you have. But Hoyle Tanner is a generally local firm. We do planning, engineering, specialize in aviation, and we'd be more than happy to help or answer any questions should you have any in the future.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Mr. Brasher, the direction you need from council today is whether or not to move forward on amending the minimum standards, and what direction are you looking for this morning?
Matt, you want
to? Well, there's a lot of discussion, a lot of proposals on the table. Do we keep with what we got? Do we move forward with amending them?
Okay.
Some direction from council.
Okay. All right. Great. Y'all want to? Anybody? I appreciate everyone that has come today, Mr. Coleman, the information that you shared. I am where I was in January. I think amending them with the one requirement and then an option on the second service. Mr. Owen, Ms. Rich, Mr. Musley, Mr. McLeod, anybody?
When can we get this to an agenda?
When can we get it to an agenda?
Are we agenda ready?
Can we have it there next week?
I can.
Okay. Are you good with amending them?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. McLeod?
Well, I'm inclined to keep the standards as they are, but let's put it on the agenda and see.
Okay.
That's what a good old-fashioned public meeting is for.
That's what we're getting for, right? It's public meeting. So.
Exactly. Right. We just, we're giving direction to staff whether or not to bring an agenda item forward. Any other care to comment?
I'm freezing.
We need to turn down the air. Mr. Musley?
Since I'm the newcomer here, I'll go ahead and just put it on the agenda.
Okay.
I need to do some more research.
All right. Sounds good. So we'll have an agenda item Tuesday night.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Are there any further comments? Anyone else have anything? All right, we're adjourned. I'm sitting here going, I need a winter coat. That's what's good about coming to Florida. Go outside and warm up.